Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Joining us, Nick Redfern. Now, he's everybody should know him. Written over 30 books now, just in fascinating area. Thank you for taking the time to talk with us today.
Oh, well, thanks for having me on the show.
Oh, it's our pleasure.
just on
yourself there, I was going to, so you've written 30 books now, I believe, right?
Yeah, that's about, I think it's about 32 or 3 published, and there's sort of 3 or 4 always in the works, you know. But it goes back 25 years. It's not like, I've been putting out 5 or 6 a year or anything like that. Although I've had a few out this year, yeah. But generally it's for about 2 books a year, something like that.
That's still a lot of, that is a lot of work, you know.
Yeah, well, sort of 6 months, I guess sort of a 6 month period really is not a bad amount of time, particularly if you've got all the information and the research done, and you know it's then just a case of actually writing the book, so to speak. That does sort of make it a lot easier, and I try and sort of remain as sort of focused as I can, you know. I mean, although it's a passion, when I'm writing, I like to sort of keep it essentially as like job hours. I start sort of 7:30 in the morning, answering emails, doing Facebook, etc. And then I typically write the books 8 to 5, Monday to Friday. So I like to take evenings off and take weekends off too. You know, I think it's important to have a life away from the subject and downtime and, right, you know, just a normal life as well, you know, as all the craziness. So, and I think it sort of keeps your mind from getting frazzled, but when you're not specifically not doing it, you know, 24/7. So, I always find that by sort of structuring it where I sort of do regular 8 to 5, Monday to Friday, for me, not for everybody, but for me that approach works in terms of being able to apply yourself and just getting down to it, you know, for sort of 4 months or whatever. So
you're very disciplined at what you do then, you know, you're very structured.
Well, I am, and the main reason being that I think it's like any self-employed job. You know, as I said, it is a passion for me, but it's also my job is, you know, full-time as a writer. But it's like any self-employed job. If, you know, you can, some people might say, oh, well, you can sleep in till noon and just, you know, potter around and do a few hours here and there. It doesn't work like that. You know, you have to be sort of on the ball, on target, and just make sure you don't, you know, miss deadlines and that kind of thing. And just because things, it's like any self-employed job, you know, you don't get the work done, you fall behind, and you fall behind, and then sort of the disaster happens, you know.
Well, yeah. Now, I also take it from my understanding is you actually go out and get the research in person, so you're not just sitting on the internet and gathering things. You actually go out.
I prefer to do field research, whether it's UFOs, Bigfoot, Loch Ness Monster, Chupacabra, you name it. And the main reason being is that, you know, I mean, it's good that you mentioned the internet, because the internet is a good resource tool for background information. But what the internet doesn't sort of necessarily provide you with is first-hand, you know, case files where In other words, when I, for example, I've been on a lot of expeditions to Puerto Rico looking for the Chupacabra, and while I've been out there, this is sort of across 2004 to 2014, I've interviewed literally dozens and dozens of people from Puerto Rico who've seen the Chupacabra, but have never ever, you know, put their stories on the internet. They were happy to share the reports privately, but they just didn't want to be bothered by everybody and his brother turning up, you know, harassing them or whatever, or just bothering them. So, in other words, when you go out to these locations, you know, you hang out with the local people and they realize you're doing this research for valid reasons, they kind of, you know, you gain their trust and vice versa, then they open up. But the internet isn't necessarily always good about or able to do that. You know, you can get background articles on the Chupacabra in Puerto Rico, but that's a far cry away from sitting in somebody's front room in a little village in the El Yunque rainforest, that kind of thing.
Right.
So that's why I do as much personal research as I can. I try to take sort of a journalistic approach of following the facts and the witness testimony, even though I'm dealing with strange and unusual topics.
Yeah, yeah, but that comes across, because in your writings then, people get the essence, they feel that in the writing. I can tell authors, and I, you know, being in the more in the media side, but I can tell people that have just done their research on Google. You know, there's just
well,
no,
we can take you, right?
Yeah, they're missing things, and they don't have the feel, they don't have the expression, they don't have the passion about something, and you can tell when you read. You know what I mean? So it's coming across that way, and I think that's great. You should be very proud of yourself because there's...
Well, thank you. Well, I mean, what I try to do, Al, for the most part, is if it's like expedition-based, you know, if the book is based around an expedition, I actually write it up as the expedition occurred. In other words, I write it up sort of road trip slash diary format, you know, literally along the lines of it was a dark and stormy night, you know, and I jumped in the Jeep, spun the wheels, and headed off into the darkness looking for the Chupacabra. That's how I sort of write those books. So,
But that's great. I mean, I think so. I think that's what I look for myself in an author and in writing, and that's what keeps me reading. So,
oh, cool.
So I think that's great. I'm glad you do that. There's so many that don't. Now, I had a lot of interest. You cover so many areas that I think are fascinating, and now you were talking about the Chupacabra, and how did that's not a very old subject, I would say. Isn't that only like about 20 years or 30 years?
Well, actually, funnily enough, it's 20 years this very year that the term Chupacabra was first used. That was in the summer of 1995 when the whole thing really began with reports of attacks on farm animals, livestock, etc., on a number of Puerto Rican small ranches and little farms. And the term Chupacabra is a Spanish term. It means goat sucker. And the reason it was given the name was because a lot of the animals that were attacked were small goats, you know, like young goats, that kind of thing. And reportedly, there were two puncture wounds on the neck and sometimes another puncture wound on the stomach. And in the initial wave of attacks, although the animals were found dead, nobody had seen the predator itself. But that changed shortly afterwards when a number of people saw this thing that they described as having a body not unlike a chimpanzee in size and build and speed, etc. But it was hairless, and it seemed to have like a row of spikes down its head and sort of like a reptilian color to its skin. There were a few odd reports, unusual reports, where people said it had large bat-like wings, which gave it almost like a gargoyle kind of imagery. And it literally plunged the people of Puerto Rico into sort of states of hysteria for several months, and you know, with major media coverage. But so I followed it from when it all began. But the first time I got the opportunity to go to Puerto Rico was in 2004, and that was with a team from a sci-fi channel show that was around back then called Proof Positive. And we spent about 8, 9, 10 days, something like that, out on Puerto Rico, just traveling around with a translator and a film crew and interviewing as many people we could about the Chupacabra.
So when you were interviewing people, first of all, how were they? Were they very receptive, and did they, or were they kind of scared to talk about it?
Well, the fortunate thing was that because it was with a TV channel, the Sci-Fi Channel had contracted a woman on the island, Carola, who could speak English and speak Spanish, and so she was a very good researcher, did a lot of TV work and things like this, and she actually was the person who tracked down all the various people for us to interview, and we got sort of background data, and so we were able to go sort of day by day and interview two or three people at different locations every day, and we got a really sort of good, solid body of varied material. For example, in one of the very first interviews we did with a rancher named Mayel, and he told us how he bred chickens, and he got chickens in cages in the sort of backyard area of his ranch. When I say ranch, you know, it's not like a huge ranch over here. A lot of the people, unfortunately, are quite poor, so his farm area, if you like, was sort of about a 70 or 80 square foot area of his backyard, that kind of thing.
Right.
But he told us how he'd woken up one morning to find all the cages sort of opened, but obviously with something that had strength, because some of the cages were bent. And they were all dead inside the cages. Now, what was weird is that the area where they were kept backed onto his back door. You would imagine in the middle of the night, with all these attacks going on, that the chickens would have been making a lot of noise and would have woken up, never mind just him, but the whole neighborhood in this little village in the rainforest. But that didn't happen. It was only when he woke up the next morning and found them all dead with these odd puncture wounds. So that was the very first case that sort of really plunged us into the heart of the mystery, if you like.
Right. That would be quite odd, I would think.
Everything about that case was odd. You know, the puncture wounds, the reports and rumors of blood loss from the animals. I mean, the animals hadn't been touched, like eaten or partially eaten. It was just the wounds, and they were left dead. But that was kind of odd because, you know, I mean, if it was a predator attacking somewhere like Puerto Rico, you know, it's going to need a regular food supply, particularly in the rainforest. You know, it's not like, say, just a wild dog, you know, wildly attacking, you know, a few sheep in a field or whatever, goats in a field. You know, this typically on Puerto Rico, predators, so to speak, are looking for food. They're not just looking to kill an animal and leave it there. But unfortunately, we weren't able to get somebody to do an autopsy of the chickens, because this was a couple of years earlier. Had that happened, we might have been able to tell if there was this reported significant blood loss through the wounds or not, you know. But that certainly quickly became like a staple part of the mystery, like a vampire-type angle to it.
Yeah. Now putting that all together, what did you sort of think this was when you first came in and you're in a small ranch, 70 by 80, and all these animals were killed overnight and nobody heard anything? So what was your first thought?
Well, my first thought was probably a correct thought, that I've been sort of, you know, thrown into this bizarre and surreal world that was even more bizarre and surreal than things I've been doing for the last 10 years, never mind just that week, you know. But the interesting thing was that Mayel came across very, very lucid, you know, credible, down to earth, and just wanted answers for what had happened, because, you know, as I said, he wasn't a rich guy, and it was his livelihood. You know, that he wasn't so much interested in telling his story for the sake of telling it. He was more concerned at the time, you know, of just, you know, his family's livelihood, putting food on the table. And so, in other words, he was looking at it from that angle. I guess from my angle, I was trying to figure out what kind of animal has the ability to be so stealthy that, you know, it can kill one chicken after another, you know, systematically without the others even knowing it before the creature's upon them. You know, there's nothing really that I could think of indigenous on Puerto Rico that could do that. I mean, although, you know, it's not that big an island, but it is a big island, and it has this huge rainforest, the El Yunque rainforest, and, you know, if you didn't know where you were, you would, and you got parachuted in, you would think you were in the middle of, you know, the South American jungle or the African jungles. It's like a huge, you know, massive jungle forested area. However, the big difference between Puerto Rico and, say, Africa or South America is there are no large predators on Puerto Rico. There's nothing like big cats, you know, bears, nothing at all. The largest animals on Puerto Rico are the imported ones, like pigs, cows, you know, cattle, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. There really isn't anything that would have the ability to sort of race around the, you know, the island of Puerto Rico, slaughtering animals, draining blood or not, you know, but just attacking and killing animals. So whatever the animal is, it's either something that suddenly was new to Puerto Rico, or it was something that had been so stealthy for so long that it took until 1995 for people to realize that there was actually something there.
Yeah, and so, and also, what was its motive? Like, what was its purpose? So, you know, if it's not eating the chickens, mm-hmm. you know, you kill them all in one night, you're not eating them or feeding them to your young, what is the purpose? You know, you do things for a reason, so...
Yeah.
Now, did they lose all their blood, like all those chickens, for instance?
Well, that's a good question. The whole issue of the blood draining or blood sucking, blood drinking, etc., is a very controversial one because, as I said, with the ranchers serene, a lot of them being very poor, you know, for the most part, solving the puzzle of what the chupacabra is really isn't at the forefront of their minds. You know, they're just interested in putting food on the table for their family, etc. So, in other words, very rarely have the ranchers even bothered to keep the animals. You know, we're talking about an environment where in the summer the temperature gets up to, you know, the low hundreds. And so for that reason, they just don't leave these corpses laying around and rotting and, you know, stinking out the environment. So they get rid of them. In other words, you know, that if it was me, it'd be a different perspective. You know, I'd keep it and try and get it, you know, analyzed or autopsied by a veterinarian. But, of course, you can't do that when you live in a little town in, you know, Puerto Rico. Again, through no fault of the people, you know, that's just their environments and life, etc. So, in other words, in terms of trying to figure out what the motivation is, you know, if they're not eating the creatures, then to systematically take time just to kill them doesn't really make sense. So this is why this scenario of the blood drinking, in part at least, came forward, because a number of witnesses did say they saw, you know, obviously the two fang marks was one of the reasons why the blood drinking angle came forward. Another one was that a number of witnesses did actually say they saw the creature not so much sucking the blood, but almost lapping it, if you like a, you know, a cat lapping milk out of a saucer, right. That kind of thing.
Yeah.
But these stories are quite controversial, and although I point out in the book I've done on this called Chupacabra Road Trip, I point out that although I've heard these blood drinking and blood sucking stories many times, so far I've never been able to prove that, you know, blood sucking actually did go on. But certainly the stories sort of proliferate all across the island.
Yeah, and that's sort of, I guess that's where the name came from.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
Now, as it went on, as your trip went on, you ran across someone that actually had a face-to-face run-in with the creature.
Yeah, this was actually, I think this is the third day we were on the island. This is a woman named Norca. Now, what's interesting is that I mentioned how the term Chupacabra was created in 1995. And people often ask me, and quite justifiably, why is it that it only began in 95? Well, there are some reports that sound, with hindsight, like Chupacabra attacks that occurred many years earlier. For example, in the 1980s, there were reports of a creature that became known as the Devil Bird. And this creature reportedly attacked animals in very similar fashion to the Chupacabra, but it died away very quickly, so it was forgotten. And the same thing happened in 1975 with a creature known as the Mocha Vampire. Mocha is an area on Puerto Rico. And that acted in a very similar fashion to the whole Devilberg and the Chupacabra scenario in the 1990s. So in other words, we have this sort of very weird situation of animal attacks going on decades ago, long before the term Chupacabra was created, but with hindsight could have been the same creature. And this sort of leads into Norca's story, this woman we interviewed. And Norca had an encounter in 1975, interestingly enough, the same year that this so-called Mocha vampire was on the loose. And she described how, well, she actually lived in this huge house in the El Yunque rainforest, high in the rainforest, and to sort of access it, you have to go around this winding road that cuts all through the rainforest to a very high height. And she still lived at that house, and that's where we did the interview. And Norca told us how she was driving home, it's sort of dusk, so it wasn't dark, but, you know, the sun was starting to set and starting to go dark. And as she was sort of driving slowly, which is the only way you can really do it in that area because the roads are so twisting and winding, she saw this creature or this thing surface on the right-hand side of the road. And she was only doing about 15 miles an hour, so she was easily able to slow down before she got too close to it. And she said it was about 5 feet high. And it almost looked like it got a cloak over its head and shoulders, and it was shuffling slowly from the right to the left. And she said she couldn't figure out what it was, you know, almost like a little old person shuffling across the road, that kind of thing. And she said that she just sat there and watched it, kind of puzzled, but then she got terrified when it turned towards her. And she saw these sort of bright red fiery eyes, and suddenly what she assumed was a cloak actually opened up into two very large bat-like wings. And it didn't take to the skies or anything like that, but she felt, possibly with hindsight, that it opened its wings as like a form of intimidation. You know, some birds will do that, you know, they'll open the wings, they're brightly colored, and it's like a sign. Often, you know, like the males of the species do it to each other when they're, you know, in the mating season to try and, you know, frighten off the other male birds. So she pondered on that and just sat there sort of frozen with fear, and this thing looked at her for about 5 or 6 seconds, then folded its wings back up and vanished to the other side of the, you know, the thick, dense rainforest environment. And she told us that she did remember that there were some animal attacks in the area in that same period. Now, what she described actually sounds something like a giant, you know, a giant bat of some sort.
Right.
There are a lot of stories of, you know, very large bats that haven't been, you know, obviously officially confirmed, but something, imagine something along the lines of a vampire bat, but with a body sort of, you know, 5 feet in length and wingspans of about 15 feet. You know, although we don't have a specimen of one of those in a zoo or anywhere, there have been a lot of reports of creatures like that. So I, you know, that's why one of the theories that's developed is the possibility, or the theory, that could the chupacabras, the devil birds, the mocha vampire, could they be some sort of huge mutant type of vampire bat? And certainly, that, you know, in the fossil record, we do see evidence of large bats that did exist in the distant past. So it's not impossible, and, you know, it's an interesting little theory.
Yeah, yeah. And so when you go on these interviews and you're traveling around the land in a place like Puerto Rico, for instance, and so you're actually in the vehicle, in the country, and you're going around and you're getting a lot of these stories told to you, and they're quite believable and quite, you know, they're quite real. How does that make you feel? Doing your interviews, do you feel like a little intimidated or a little bit nervous or anxious?
No, that's not sort of my character. I mean, when I get out into the field, for me, it's more like sort of an adrenaline rush. It's excitement, and I want to, you know, try and solve the mystery. You know, I'm one of these who I'm happy about asking questions, knocking on doors, and, you know, just... I mean, what we did it a couple of times was just sort of walk into, from one of these little villages, was sort of walk into the local bar or the store and say, hey, you know, does anybody have any chupacabra stories? I mean, you know, just come straight to the point and be forthright about it. But, you know, so I don't sort of get frightened or worried or anything like that, but I sort of find it more exciting, and, you know, I feel driven to look for the answers, and the more data you get, the more it sort of pushes me on, and I think that's the best way to do it. If we're going to get answers, there's no point being sort of like an apologist for it, you know, or taking the view, oh, would you mind, you know, telling me this, etc. You know, I put it how it is to people. You know, I'm here, and if you can help me, I'd be very much appreciative, you know. So I try and, you know, take the approach of, well, this is like a journalistic story, and like any journalistic story, you've got to get a foot in the door, and you've got to pursue it to the, you know, the best degree that you can.
Yeah, yeah. And that, now, the was there a lot of people that had seen and give you descriptions of the actual creature that was doing this?
Yeah, most of the, I think altogether over the 11 years that I've been to Puerto Rico on many expeditions, I've probably now got somewhere in the region of, I would say, 30 or 40 witness reports. And the vast majority of them, apart from literally like 1, 2, 3, 4, something like that, talk about a creature that apparently has the ability to move on 2 limbs and 4 limbs. You know, I mean, there are a few animals, known animals, that will do that. Like, for example, the baboon. You know, they can skillfully do that. And a bear will stand up on its hind legs, obviously, but their main, you know, form of walking is on 4 limbs. But the creature of Puerto Rico is predominantly described as having, you know, a sort of total control when it's sort of walking and running on 2 limbs or 4 limbs. It's sort of, you know, adept at both. I would say a good 50 or 60% of the reports describe like a row of spikes down its head and down the back of its neck, which kind of gives like an image of sort of a punk rock mohawk or something like that, as how one of the witnesses actually described it. And I would probably say 7 or 8% of the people, something like that, a very small percentage, talk about the wings. Now, admittedly, some of the witnesses said that they didn't see wings until the thing actually opened its wings. So, you know, that's an important thing, that there could have been more sort of wing-based reports had the people not just seen the creature fleetingly and possibly just from the front. You know, if they'd seen it from behind, it might have been a different story. But the other important thing to remember, of course, is although, you know, obviously the ranchers tend to find their animals attacked when they get up in the morning, most of the attacks occur during the night, and most of the sightings occur late at night. So, in other words, when you're in an environment where, you know, here in the U.S., we're bombarded by light pollution, in Puerto Rico, you get outside of the main city of San Juan. When you're out, you know, in the little towns and villages, there aren't any street lights for the most part. It's very, very dark. You know, the only illumination is from the homes. And when you're getting out into the real countryside, I mean, it's sort of pitch black. So for the witnesses, that can make it doubly difficult to get a full positive description when they might have a fleeting view of it for, say, 5 or 10 seconds in an area where the only illumination is perhaps from their car headlamps or if they've got a flashlight. You know, there's no huge street signs, street lamps, that kind of thing. So, it's, you know, very, in that sense, it can be challenging for the witness to actually have a full understanding of what they're seeing.
So now, have there been any humans that have been attacked or had their blood sucked?
Well, you know, that's an interesting question. I'll tell you why it is so interesting, is because every time I've been to Puerto Rico, I've heard these stories of chupacabra attacks on people. There literally has not been a time when I haven't been to Puerto Rico that I haven't heard these stories. But I have to admit that these have been the most difficult ones to chase down. And as far as I've got with these stories is where, you know, somebody has said, well, I got it from this person and they got it from that person, you know, sort of friend of a friend stories.
Right.
Now that, you know, as I've always, when I've ever been asked this question, I always point out that it doesn't necessarily mean that the stories are just like an urban legend or folklore. But what I do think is that if there have been human attacks and human killings, that would be without doubt the one area that, you know, the local authorities on the island would want to keep under wraps. So it doesn't surprise me that so many of these stories are reportedly shrouded in secrecy. I mean, there are accounts of, you know, people who know of this particular angle supposedly being warned and threatened not to talk about them, which, again, you know, has a sort of a degree of urban legend about it. But on the other hand, as I said, it would make sense that the very last thing you would want to admit to was, you know, this creature's now turned its attention to people, because that really would whip up the hysteria to, you know, just a frenzied level across the entire island. So I do take a lot of interest in these human attacks, and I've heard a lot of reports very similar, like puncture wounds on the neck, and, you know, somebody stumbled across the body looking very, very pale, and then the authorities come in, you know, the police come in, and then a higher entity, if you like, takes over and, you know, takes control of the whole situation, shuts the people up, and it actually goes out of the police's hands. So, you know, it's not impossible, I think, that there could be something to these stories.
And what's the rumors about the military taking and capturing some of them and taking them to the mainland?
Yeah, well, that's actually something that, again, I've heard several times. It relates to a military base on the island of Puerto Rico, which is now shut down, called Roosevelt Roads. And it was actually a U.S. naval base. You know, sort of like actually the largest U.S. naval base in the area, and a huge place. But it closed down in 2004. Now, I'm sure everybody sort of heard, a lot of people have heard, I should say, these stories about the U.S. government having sort of dead alien bodies, you know, in,
yeah,
in bunkers and hangars where they're sort of cryogenically preserved, you know, recovered from UFO crashes 30, 40, 50 years ago, and they have people come in now and again to autopsy them and study them and try and figure out what they are. Well, there's kind of similar stories to that with the Chupacabra in Puerto Rico. Over the years, I've probably got four, five, six stories, something like that, of people who claim to know that the U.S. military from Roosevelt Roads reportedly were able to capture some pretty vicious living Chupacabras and also kill some others, and that they were reportedly flown in sort of like steel cages, placed in steel, sedated, the ones that weren't dead, placed in steel cages, transferred to the US, and then, you know, for some destination unknown, but some sort of military installation, you know, something along the lines of Area 51, that kind of thing.
Right.
And the stories were quite detailed about how the living ones, you know, the military apparently knew where they had their sort of lair, which was a particular cave system. And it, what's interesting is that Puerto Rico has a vast, literally massive number of caves, caverns, and cave networks that sort of go not just along the island, but deep underground. And some of these cave systems are actually out of bounds to the general public. Interestingly enough, this is down to the, you know, Puerto Rican government. They literally, you know, it's against the law to go into some of these caves, which sort of adds to the conspiracy as well. And, you know, that's actually not hearsay. That's fact. You know, there are signs that say, you know, access to these particular caves is forbidden by, you know, the law of Puerto Rico. Hmm. One of the stories is about, you know, a number of these chupacabras being tracked to one of these specific caves. Some of them were reportedly killed, as I said. Others were, you know, essentially knocked out, you know, and then taken to the U.S. for study. The stories have been sort of quite detailed and have just come from, yeah, regular villagers who lived in those areas and said, yeah, we heard about the, you know, the guys at Roosevelt Roads getting their hands on these bodies, and people who knew of the site being told not to talk about this, and et cetera, et cetera. So, again, it's sort of a fascinating part of the picture. But, again, I think that if there's truth to it, it's not surprising that it would have been so sort of steeped in secrecy and steps would have been taken to ensure that, you know, nothing really surfaced out of, you know, official quarters.
Yeah. Now, do you sort of associate this creature with the things known as Dogman and things like that on the mainland more so?
Well, you know, I mean, but all of these creatures, whether it's sort of Bigfoot, the
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to 1 full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full, important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Loch Ness Monster, Chupacabra, they're collectively all known as cryptids. And the name comes from the subject of cryptozoology. Cryptozoology being the study of unknown animals or unacknowledged animals. But in terms of, you know, associations and connections, the one similarity, the main similarity that we have between the chupacabra and the so-called dogman is this ability to sort of run and walk on two legs and four. You know, the dogman, it sort of provokes imagery of werewolves. And whenever you mention werewolves, you know, you have this picture in your mind of somebody bursting out of the clothes on a full moon and change it into this, like, you know, yeah, killer werewolf, which can only be stopped with, like, the silver bullet or whatever.
Yeah.
But what's interesting is if you look at a lot of the reports that people like, particularly Linda Godfrey, who more than anybody else has done, you know, a massive amount of research and written, I think, 5 or 6 books now on this topic, Linda hardly has a case of somebody claiming to, you know, literally morphed and transformed, you know, from human form into a werewolf. Most of the reports, although they have like a werewolf quality to them, they actually don't involve, you know, this traditional image of shape-shifting, as it's called, you know, and and transforming from one creature to another, human to wolf or wolf-like animal. Most of the reports Linda has are of creatures that seem to be wolf-like, but as I said, can move on two limbs and four. And that is very similar to the Puerto Rican chupacabra, but that's pretty much where the similarities end. You know, there are a lot of reports of the dogmen, you know, sort of scavenging food and things like that, and you know, carcasses and etc. Whereas the Puerto Rican creature, it just seems to kill the animals, unless it really is for sort of the blood aspect. And a lot of the reports Linda has got, there's a lot of sort of paranormal associations with them as well, sort of being seen in the vicinity of ancient mounds or cemeteries and, you know, things like this. And whereas the Puerto Rican chupacabra is more, you know, it's just seen where you'd expect it to be seen, in the rainforest. So, but, you know, there are, I said there is that interesting parallel of, you know, two legs to four legs, so to speak.
And how do you answer? This is a question that comes up with all creatures. How do you answer that there's no bodies?
Well, you know, that's an extremely good question. It's one I get all the time. Now, the one answer, which has a degree of plausibility to it, but it cannot obviously explain everything, is the notion that, or not the notion, but the fact that, you know, when something dies in the woods, the local animals don't just let it lay there, you know. Nature has a way of getting rid of these things, and, you know, it's called the other animals in the forest, you know. It doesn't take long. You say, for example, a bear dies in the woods before, you know, other animals move in, and it's dinner and breakfast and lunch for the next few days.
Yeah.
And, you know, they pick the bones clean. You know, they may sort of, the bones may get tossed around here and there as they're eating them, or they're competing with other animals for the body as well. So that could certainly explain, you know, a large number of reports as why we don't have a body of a Bigfoot, for example. Now, the other theories that have been put forward they offer an explanation, but they do so by, I guess, offering even bigger layers of mystery, because you have the idea that Bigfoot is sort of a paranormal creature, like a, you know, a spirit guardian of the woods, that kind of thing, rather than a physical flesh and blood animal, you know. And if it was something like that, that of course then requires us to explain, well, what is a spirit guardian of the woods and how does that exist, you know? And so that would explain why we wouldn't find the bones of that, but it requires us to obviously present a case for how something like a spirit monster could exist. Then you have sort of the more intriguing theories that what if Bigfoot isn't just an unknown ape, but is a highly evolved creature that looks primitive but actually isn't. That being the case, you know, suggestions have been made that they have sort of burial rites even. You know, we actually think that we're the only ones that sort of mourn and, you know, bury. Well, we aren't really the only ones that bury our dead. However, with elephants, for example, when one of the, you know, the herd dies, they mourn quite like we do. And you can find examples online where, for example, somebody, you know, is out filming and where an elephant's just recently died, and the other members of the group, they place like twigs and small branches over the body of the elephant. You know, they're not really burying it, but it's like they're giving some sort of you know, paying homage to it and covering it up and, you know, understanding, you know, what death is. And they mourn a lot. So, you know, in other words, possibly Bigfoot does that as well. Now, the only downside I have with all this is that even I find it difficult to believe that we could never get a body. You know, I could understand how 90% of the time, if these things do bury their dead, that we wouldn't find them, and perhaps then that would leave another 5%, you know, get eaten by scavengers or whatever. But for us to never get a body is troubling, you know. I mean, even I have to admit that, you know, I don't come out and say, yeah, oh, there's explanations for all this. There actually isn't, you know. But that is one of the big problems, and that's why I'm sort of open-minded on what Bigfoot is, you know. Is it just an ape, or is there something paranormal about it, you know, that takes it away from being a regular physical animal, even one that we don't know what it is? You know, all we can kind of do is just try and build up more data, and hopefully one day we'll have enough data to explain, you know, why Bigfoot and a lot of these other things are so elusive.
Yeah, I just talked to another author that talked, he was saying how it was a time slip, you know, and portals,
yeah.
that thought, yeah. where they could kind of come in and out. And, mm-hmm. You know,
well, that's an interesting theory. I mean, for example, quantum physics today is allowing for the existence of multi-dimensions. I mean, probably the best way to describe it in simple terms is, you know, you're driving the car and you've got the radio on, you don't like the song that's playing, so you tune into another show, and you don't like that song, so you tune into another and another till you find one you like. And in other words, you have all these stations, all these shows, all these channels going on at the same time, but you can only be tuned into one at any given moment. And that's how, you know, the simple explanation for what quantum physics is allowing for, multi-dimensions all going on at the same time, but you can only be, you know, you can only access one at any given moment. And if these things, you know, have an understanding of what we might call portals, or as John Keel, who wrote the Mothman Prophecy book, called them window areas, where, you know, something could come in and out of our reality, and they knew how to do it, but we don't. That might explain this sort of overwhelming elusiveness.
Yeah, yeah. I just know that I have 200 channels, and I can never find anything. Just keep on going. Is this an ongoing? Now, is it still happening in Puerto Rico? Or are they still having these issues?
Well,
animals being killed?
Yeah. Well, that's a good question, because every time I've been to Puerto Rico, I've got new reports. But the reason I've got them is because I've been out there and I've took the time and energy to track people down and find them and interview them, and then they may have referred me to somebody else. So, in other words, reports are going on, but we only know about them because people actually go in looking for them. In other words, if people don't go looking for them, it's not like back in 95 when there was all the hysteria. It's not today. People aren't just coming forward and saying, oh, you know, I saw this creature, because all the hysteria has died down. So, in other words, from the outside, it looks like there's not much going on, because not much is being reported on the internet. And, well, if it's not on the internet, it can't be real, you know.
Yeah.
So that's the situation.
Yeah.
You know, if it's not on the internet, the internet says it's not going on, it's not going on.
Yeah.
However, it's very different, as I said, when you get back out there and you gain the trust of the people, and they'll say, well, you know, there is a guy you could speak to who had an encounter sort of 4 years ago or 2 years ago. But again, I would not have known about that. I had not gone. So, you know, the skeptics often say, well, it was just mass hysteria because nobody else reports them. And then so I say to those same skeptics, well, have you been out and actually looked to see if there are any reports in the last couple of years? Like, well, no. You know, so that's what we're up against. It's all very well to say nothing's going on, but if the people haven't bothered to look and actually go out there to see if anything's going on, you're going to get a distorted image, and that distortion does suggest that, you know, it's died off, but it actually hasn't.
Yeah. But wouldn't the creature get a Twitter and Facebook page? And
oh, well, you know, there are active pages, you know, dedicated to the, you know, the monster of this particular lake, or the creature of those woods. You know, you can find them all over the place. You know, a lot of them are really good because they do offer, like, a lot of tourist information and hot spots, that kind of thing. So, you know, they actually do, as well as the entertainment angle, they do actually present, you know, a useful resource tool for everything from, like, you know, the local motels to check into, and the hot spots where the, you know, the lake monsters are predominantly seen in this part of the water, you know, versus this side of the lake or whatever. You know, they're seen more in the deeper areas. And so, you know, I think that's all sort of good, you know, and a lot of it's entertainment-based, and I don't think there's anything wrong with that if it's, you know, we understand it for what it is. And we can apply, you know, a lot of that to the legitimate investigations as well. And so I think all of the data collectively sort of helps the search, if you like.
Yeah, I just think it would be great if one of these creatures, like Bigfoot, had his own real page. They came out of the closet, and they're out.
Well, who knows? I mean, stranger things have happened, I guess. So.
And they start doing selfies and take pictures of their lunch. And they take pictures of their lunch.
Yeah, like sort of with a deer over its shoulder or something like that.
Oh, it's just silly.
Topped off with like a bit of mayonnaise and some pickles.
Yeah. I think so. I would love that. You know, so what's your overall opinion of of the whole creature cryptozoology sort of area, as you do spend so much time researching that.
Well, I mean, my personal view is I think there's two things going on. I think we have legitimately unknown, there's several things going on. We have legitimately totally unknown animals like the chupacabra and other ones, somewhat obscure ones like the Mongolian death worm, which is like this 5 foot long worm that can apparently lives under the sands and can electrocute people, not unlike an electric eel does in the oceans. There's actually a lot of good data to suggest that exists. And on the island of Sumatra, there's this small ape-like creature that walks completely upright like a human, known as the Orang Pendek. And I actually think all these are real animals that we're going to find in probably in the near future. A lot of really good stuff on the Orang Pendek. I really do think that will be found soon. And they're, for me at least, they're unknown animals. Now, there are other creatures which could potentially be surviving relics from periods long gone, which we're told they've become extinct, and they actually didn't. For example, a classic example is the coelacanth, a large fish, which was presumed until the 1930s to have been extinct for millions of years, and then one was caught off the coast of South Africa in 1935. And since then, there have been other examples where today they're not captured because they're so scarce, they're just filmed. But, they were around millions of years ago, and they survived quite nicely. It's not like they were small little fish. They were like 9 to 10 feet long, and they still are. But they survived detection for millions of years. So I think we could be dealing with a few things like that. Possibly that might explain some of these giant bat reports, possibly some sea serpent reports. They could have been marine reptiles, possibly from, the Jurassic era, things like plesiosaurs, which, again, we know they died out, but there could have been others that survived. Then there's this other more controversial category we just touched on, the idea of some of them being more paranormal-based. And I don't rule this out, not just because of the weird nature of these things, like the Dogman, but the fact that they're seen time and again in areas that are sort of traditionally tied to paranormal phenomena, like graveyards and like in Britain, like ancient stone circles, we get a lot of reports of weird creatures, like so-called black panthers, or alien big cats, as they're known in the UK, ABCs. But they're so often seen, as I said, around graveyards, around stone circles, and they have a lot, some of these reports have sort of supernatural qualities attached to them. So I think the field of cryptozoology, should be sort of split into several categories: extinct versus not extinct, unknown animals, and creatures that are so bizarre that, they do have sort of these sort of supernatural aspects to them.
Wow. Yeah, it's quite a... It still has a lot of room for research.
Oh, yes. I don't think that will ever really end. I mean, you can find reports of sea serpents in old ships' logs from, the 15 and 1600s. You can find stories, actually from the time of Alexander the Great, where one of his armies actually described a confrontation with these large, violent, ape-like animals. We're talking about going back, never mind centuries, but we're talking about millennia, in the past. So I think as long as there are weird mysteries out there, people can look for them, because whether they believe them or not, everybody loves a mystery. Everybody loves sort of a campfire story. Or everybody loves Halloween. You don't have to be a kid to love Halloween, It's sort of just that spooky, weird, fun night when, the demons or the ghosts come out, etc. We all have that sort of innate, interest in these things, whether we admit it or not. I think, particularly in today's world where, a lot of it's sort of internet dominated, etc., I think people still like the idea of, there could be places in the world and things living in them that we don't know about, and it sort of provokes intrigue and adventure that, to a degree at least, the internet's taken that away. Particularly with young kids, they don't sort of go out and play in the woods like we did and get scratched up and fall off your bike and, hanging off a rope and, throwing yourself into the river, that kind of thing. It doesn't happen that much anymore. Kids just stay indoors and, you know, text or whatever.
Yeah.
And I think that's a shame. But I think also we recognize, you know, that we are inquiring animals, basically, you know, and we are all, to a degree, I think, interested in one mystery or another.
Just put out a book, The Men in Black, and that's the third in that series, Men in Black.
Men in Book Black.
Yeah. So, so what was the update? Like, you added new things to this, and what new information did you come up with?
Well, you know, the whole Men in Black mystery is one of my favorite things to write about. Now, the new book is, Men in Black, is the third book that I've done on this particular subject. And you know, when you write on a particular subject and people may have had an experience, they tend to contact you, or that they look for somebody who's written on that subject to share the story with, to see if they get answers. That's why, you know, I don't do much in the way of ghost hunting. Not because I avoid it, but it just doesn't really interest me that much. So, in other words, I rarely ever get anyone ever contact me about ghosts. But, you know, obviously they look for people who do cover that area. And so that sort of brings me to the Men in Black mystery. You know, I've written extensively about the Men in Black, and so when you write about it, people contact you, and, you know, I get literally dozens of stories per year. Now, when people think of the Men in Black, their first thought, I guess, probably is sort of Will Smith and Tommy Lee Jones, you know, with
the movie
versions. That's certainly for the members of the general public who aren't necessarily familiar with the Men in Black history, that certainly is their first image. And for a lot of people I know, they assume that the Men in Black mystery was created by Hollywood in the mid-1990s for the movies. But it's actually the other way around. The movies were based on a comic book series, and the comic books were inspired by real-life reports. And the term Men in Black actually goes back to 1956, when a guy named Gray Barker wrote a book called They Knew Too Much About Flying Saucers. And most of the book was focused on a guy named Albert Bender, who created the UFO research group in Bridgeport, Connecticut, called the International Flying Saucer Bureau. And Bender created this group in 1952, and it went from strength to strength very, very quickly, to the point where Bender had hundreds and hundreds of subscribers all around the world, the United States, Canada, Australia, Europe, etc., etc. And then suddenly, without warning, Bender announced that he was going to close it down, and he alluded to being visited by these three guys in black suits. Now, as I said, Gray Barker wrote this book, They Knew Too Much About Flying Saucers, in 1956, and he was friends with Bender, but Bender was someone who was an unusual character, and he didn't want to say too much, and he was heavily sort of steeped in the world of the occult. I mean, sort of like dark occult stuff, you know, creating altars to try and summon up supernatural entities and all this kind of thing. And he was heavily into, as I said, the dark side of the occult. And he was a big fan of, like, Edgar Allan Poe and H.P. Lovecraft, people like that. And Bender didn't sort of deny Barker's interpretation that the Men in Black were agents of the government, and that's how that sort of scenario developed. However, as time went on, it became clear that Bender's Men in Black was something very, very different. For example, he finally came clean and said, well, he wrote his own book eventually, but he quit the subject forever. He never, ever came back. This was in 62. But his Men in Black, he described them as being sort of 5 feet to 5 feet 5 tall, very skinny. Their skin was almost the color of milk, and they looked, you know, anemic and sick. And they had these sort of fiery, blazing eyes, you know, that they sounded like some sort of like a supernatural vampire. And what's interesting is, if you read most of the stories, the overwhelming majority of all the reports I get of the Men in Black are just like that. They're sort of super creepy, weird looking, vampire overtones to them, where they only sort of pretty much surface at night. And very often, when they knock on people's front doors, they don't force their way in. They wait to be invited in, which sort of ties in with the old vampire legend that a vampire has to be invited into your home the first time it visits. And there are a lot of weird parallels with other phenomena with the Men in Black visits. The people who, for example, you know, with the movies, the Men in Black covert silence people who've seen UFOs. Well, I've got some cases where there was no UFO component, but the people have been dabbling with Ouija boards, and they felt with hindsight that they sort of opened a portal or a window area, you know, as we were talking about earlier with why we don't find the bodies of Bigfoot. They felt they'd sort of opened a portal to allow these things in. I've got other cases where the Men in Black had visited people's homes, and the people, after they left, experienced violent, allegedly described violent poltergeist activity in the home. So, you know, in other words, the Hollywood image of the sort of the so-called Men in Black being secret agents is actually very far removed from the real reports of these sort of strange, skinny little guys in bad-fitting suits. And something very bizarrely, there have been reports where people have said, you know, they look like a corpse dug it up. You know, like a reanimated corpse is the only way to sort of describe them. So, you know, the Hollywood angle is an entertaining and a fun one, but the real angle is so far removed and so bizarre as to be almost unbelievable. But I mean, I get cases today that are extremely similar to Albert Bender in the early 50s, where they still turn up today in like the old style gangster suits and black fedoras. You know, they just, everything about them is just so odd.
But now these guys, the Men in Black too, because on the movies, they're made to look like they're just out for UFOs and aliens. But
yeah,
in real life, like the Men in Black reports, like what you're talking about, cover a lot of other areas.
Well, yeah, that's actually a good point, a very good point, that most people don't realize, because the Men in Black mystery becomes so inextricably tied to the UFO phenomenon. They think that's why these sort of secret agents, or, you know, agents of some shadow group within the government is the one, you know, that are doing all this. But, I mean, I've got reports where, you know, not only with the like the Ouija board angle, but where people have been sort of dabbling in things like demonology. I mean, a really creepy case I've got in the new book is where a couple of guys, one of them is actually now a famous voiceover guy. He does voiceover for numerous TV shows. His name's Peter Beckman. And I interviewed Peter for the book, and he told me how, he couldn't remember, it was either 1969 or 1970, it was one of the two. He and a friend were listening to the soundtrack of the movie Rosemary's Baby, which had just come out in 68, and, you know, they got the soundtrack on vinyl, I think it was that there. Or it may have been, you know, like a reel-to-reel thing, I'm not sure. But anyway, they were listening to the soundtrack of Rosemary's Baby, and they got to the Black Mass track came on, and they suddenly, they felt weird and sort of spaced out and, you know, didn't, almost in like an altered state of mind. And they saw this black car pull up outside the house, like something, you know, again, like one of these old-style 1950s Cadillacs, you know, with the shark fin tails, and it's totally black. And they said they had vague memories of hearing a slow knocking on the front door and feeling compelled, almost as if they were being mind control to open the door. And when they opened the door, there were these two strange looking men in black, looked very, very sick and ill. The suits didn't fit them right, and they came in, and Peter told me how he remembered they were sort of grilled and questioned and interrogated, and but he felt his mind was being sort of sapped, if you like, and you know, in terms that these things were trying to pull information from his mind, and he had no sort of real full recollection of what happened, but vague snippets. But he said the timing, you know, the whole issue of listening to this, the soundtrack to this occult movie, and then the Black Mass section comes on, and suddenly this creepy encounter with these two guys with the black suits and the fedoras. You know, I've got so many stories like that, and you have offshoots of the Men in Black. Like, for example, the Shadow People or the Hat Man, which is one that's surfaced in the last few years, which is like a shadowy form that people see in their bedrooms. They wake up, the Hat Man and the Shadow People is pretty much sort of part of the same phenomenon, where people wake up in the middle of the night sort of frozen and unable to move. and they see this menacing, well, a pretty shadowy form in the corner of the room, which is very often described as menacing. They sort of, you know, gives off this sense of fear or creates fear. But very often, this shadowy silhouette is wearing like a black fedora. So, you know, this is sort of paralleled with the Men in Black as well, creating sort of a very, very real but weird phenomenon, which, as I said, is, you know, not most people's perceptions of who or what the Men in Black actually are.
Hmm. Yeah, it just leaves a lot to think about on that. What do you come up, like, what's the most popular story, or the general story that you get, that what are the Men in Black in general trying to do?
Yeah, well, this is again where it gets down, you know, goes down weird pathways. I mean, for example, if you or me or most people, you know, late at night, you're watching TV at midnight or something, and you hear this slow bang on the front door, you're definitely not going to open the door without, at very least, looking through the spy hole. And if you don't see one of your friends, you know, or your neighbours in a panic, or the police, you're probably not going to open the door. But you would probably phone the police. Yeah. But the people visited by the Men in Black, they don't do that. Typically what happens is, you know, there's this slow knock at the door, and then it's as if the person's mind has been placed into an altered state, like Peter Beckman, where it's as if their common sense factors have gone out of the window, or they've just been placed, almost like one described it, like coming around from anaesthetic after a surgery, that, you know, your mind, you start saying stupid things until your mind begins to clear. And that's how the people feel, that their mind has been placed into an altered state, to where they do go to the door, they open it, and they allow these things to come in. And things is probably a good description for them. And they come in, and then they sit down and they start interrogating the witness about a UFO encounter or some other bizarre encounter. There's been Bigfoot that have been visited by the Men in Black, and, you know, as I said, the Ouija board angle. And typically there are reports of just one, but typically it's either two or mainly three Men in Black will turn up. Sometimes it's women in black as well, and they kind of have this pale look and emotionless look as well. And what happens is that, you know, they reel off these questions, and the people feel to, you know, they just have to spill their guts, so to speak. They tell them everything they want to know. And one usually asks the questions, and another one is usually just intently staring at the person, and quite in, like, which is what is usually described, like a very malevolent, almost evil, hate-filled way. There are some very creepy stories where the witnesses said they felt that as they were watching or speaking to the Men in Black, and they were watching them, that these things were sort of draining them of energy. One described it as how a diabetic must feel if they miss breakfast and lunch, and then it's 9 o'clock at night, and they start to, you know, they go into crash mode where, you know, their life's in danger, and the witnesses have felt sort of clammy and cold, short of breath and dizzy and lightheaded and vertigo, as if, and weak, you know, as if they were lacking in energy, and they felt they were almost like a psychic vampire. So that is sort of the typical way the witnesses react, and that's how the Men in Black seem to take control of the whole situation, by affecting the person's mind. And then what usually happens is that when they're finished, they get up and leave. The person shuts the door and sits down, and they're almost in like a daze for 5 or 10 minutes. Like I said, coming around from anesthetic, and when they do finally return to normal, then they stand up and race to the door, thinking, why on earth did I let them in? But of course, that 10 minutes in which the person is sort of slowly coming back to normal again has given them plenty of time to leave and exit the area, which, you know, may explain why, again, that, like with Bigfoot, a lot of these other things, they're never caught, because, you know, they found a way to elude us and get away before we ever even a chance to go looking for them.
Strange things in the world.
Yeah. To be honest, you know, the Men in Black stories, the real ones, do sound, you know, far less X-Files based, and really, like, far more like a cross between, like, Edgar Allan Poe and H.P. Lovecraft. You know, that they, if somebody wrote novels about them, the real stories, they would be placed, you know, not on the sci-fi shelf or the UFO shelf. They would be in the horror occult section.
Well, maybe that's where we'll put them. Well, it's been a pleasure. We are running out of time. So how about giving your information for the people that are listening?
Okay. Well, people can reach me. I have a blog, which is called Nick Redfern's World of Whatever, and the address is http://nickredfernfortean, that's F-O-R-T-E-A-N, nickredfernfortean.blogspot.com. People can reach me at Facebook and Twitter. There's 9 or 10 Nick Redferns at Facebook, but if you scroll down, you'll find me. I'm always happy to chat with people, you know, if they want to share cases or if they want advice on, you know, something that's happened to them. And, you know, I'm always happy to share information or try and help someone if they've had an experience that's worrying them or troubling them, or they just want to know more about the subject. And most of my books you can get off the shelves in Barnes & Noble, or if not, you can get them online at Amazon as well.
Very good. Well, thank you very much. I hope to have you back again. It's just very interesting to talk to you.
Oh, well, thanks, Al. Yeah, I mean, I enjoyed it, and we covered a lot of ground, a lot of different areas. And
the mission has been completed.
The end! By George, he's got it! It is the end!
I'll see you.
This has been a production of the Z-Talk Radio Network.
If you're lying to me, I'll be back.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.